Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Al Worden. Al was command module pilot for the Apollo 15 mission to the moon in 1971. He spent 6 days orbiting the moon, including 3 days completely alone. Can you imagine what that was like to be flying this module so many, hundreds of thousands of miles from Earth, right next to the moon, and you're all by yourself going around the moon? He conducted the first spacewalk in deep space during the return from the moon to the Earth, becoming the first human ever to see the entire Earth and the moon simply by turning his head. It's Apollo 15 capped really a very impressive career as an astronaut. He worked on Apollo 9, Apollo 12 missions, as well as the perilous flight of Apollo 13. He also tells the story of his firing. 9 months after his return from the moon, he received a phone call telling him that he was fired and ordering him out of his office by the end of the week. He refused to leave. Maybe that's what we should do when that kind of news comes. We just refuse to leave. Never told the full story around the events that ended his spaceflight career. He does in this book. The book is Falling to Earth, and Al is our guest this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm sure we will have many for him. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Al.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you, sir? You sound chipper.
Well, I'm sitting out here in absolutely gorgeous weather in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Oh, we have the same in Milwaukee. It is a beauty of a day.
Well, yeah, and I was just telling Ron a minute ago, as soon as we finish, I'm off to play a round of golf.
Right now?
Well, in an hour from now.
Okay. I hope you
I'm not going to leave you stranded this time.
All right. Thank you, Al. Thank you, Al. I want to start with, because you're one of the few people on Earth who's gone around the moon, and you had this glimpse that we'll never have, and you talk about this glimpse into infinity. So let's start with the big stuff, and then we'll talk about training and everything. What's it like to glimpse into infinity from where you were?
Well, that was really weird. I spent 6 days in lunar orbit. I went around it 75 times, and every time I came around the side of the moon, I got to a window to watch the Earth rise, which was really spectacular. That's something that everybody should see. But when I was on the other side of the moon, when I was away from the sun, in the shadow of the sun and in the shadow of the Earth, there's a small segment of the orbit around the backside of the moon where you're in total darkness, and I happened to spend a lot of time looking out at the rest of the universe out there, and I got to tell you, it's really mind-boggling. We have no concept of what the universe is all about. We have no idea what infinity is or what time is. It's just there. It was so spectacular that I had to believe that there's a kind of a guiding hand behind it. You know, the interesting thing is that we're part of the Milky Way galaxy. We're about two-thirds of the way out one of the arms of the Milky Way galaxy, and in that galaxy there are something like anywhere from 200 to 400 billion stars with a B. And then when you look out at the rest of the universe, you know, when you find out afterwards that there are some 200 billion galaxies out there, you begin to see that we're pretty short-sighted here on Earth. We don't understand what the universe is all about. So it was pretty spectacular.
I can't imagine going around the moon being as far as you were from Earth, and you're all by yourself because your other astronauts are on the moon. That would probably drive me to another realm of existence. How did you handle the incredible isolation of that?
Well, I got to tell you, that was the best part of flight for me.
Really?
Oh, yeah, that was wonderful. I had that whole spacecraft all to myself for a change. and that was kind of fun. After being with Dave Scott and Jim Irwin for 4.5 days getting ready for their landing, it was kind of a pleasure for them to go somewhere else and give me the whole thing all to myself. That spacecraft is pretty small. It's about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. So getting rid of those two guys was a real joy for a while. And I kept in contact with them when they were down there, and it was fun to get them back. But I thoroughly enjoyed the time by myself, and especially when I was on the backside of the moon, away from Earth, where Mission Control couldn't even get me. So I was totally by myself back there with no radio communications, and I just was able to do all the things that I had to do and look out at the universe and watch the Earth rise, and it was a wonderful time.
Mm. You did a lot of studying of geology before you made this journey,
right?
Because
mm-hmm.
you wanted to know what the moon was going to look like. And you loved it. You loved studying geology.
Well, I have to tell you, I love the geology side of things. If put it in the right terms, Dave Scott and Jim Irwin studied what I will call microgeology. That's where they got down on the surface of the moon and they picked up rocks and brought them back. I did what I'll call macrogeology. I looked at large features. What we were trying to decide at the time, and it's kind of surprising how fast we've come in our knowledge of the moon, but at the time we made our flight, there was a big controversy about whether the features on the moon, like the big dark circles we see on the face of the moon, were made by volcanic action or by meteor impact. And so my task was to look for features that would indicate volcanism on the moon, or look at the craters and see what they told us about meteor impacts. And as a matter of fact, I found a field of cinder cones with my eye. They said I wouldn't be able to see them. They were too small, but I did see them. And that resulted in Apollo 17 going to that site to check out the volcanic activity there. It was very ancient volcanic activity, but it had been there. So that kind of solved one of the puzzles we had about the moon. There is volcanic activity, or was, in you know, millions of years ago. There are a lot of lava flows on the moon that can be seen from orbit, and there are a lot of evidences of volcanic activity. But the major events on the moon were meteor impacts, and that's what created the big, what we call Mare basins on the face of the moon that we see all the time.
Mm-hmm. You say at one point, or you ask the question, and I'd like for you to answer this, are we in some way hardwired to do these kinds of trips to explore space?
Well, I think yes, we are. I think it's a long-term project. I think if we reflect for a minute on the imperative that every biological living thing on Earth has, the imperative is survival of the species. And that goes for everything that grows, even the plants that grow. They have mechanisms to ensure their survival. Animals do the same thing, and humans are no different. Our big problem coming up in the future sometime, and it's going to be maybe a billion years from now, is that, you know, and we already know this, that the sun is going to burn through all of its energy someday, and that's going to leave us isolated, and we're going to have to find another place to go. And so I do believe that there's a genetic drive in us to explore other places and find another planet that's livable.
Mm.
We're making very, very baby steps right now going to the moon. The next step will be probably going to Mars. But the whole purpose of the space program, tens of thousands of years from now, is to be able to go someplace where we get a sun that's not about ready to die. We find a planet that we can live on, and we migrate, and just like people do here on Earth.
I just can't take that in, I must tell you. I can't imagine that,
well,
Al.
Well, I understand that. That's a pretty long-term view,
right,
Kathleen.
Right. I love the description, and please tell me about this. You do have another book, I Want to Know About a Flight to the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
Fred Rogers wrote the intro to it, and you had a conversation with him, which I'm sure you'll remember forever. Tell us about how you got Fred Rogers interested in filming.
Well, that was sort of an interesting story. Fred was a very dear friend. I did not know him before my flight. About a month before the flight, I picked up the phone and called Sesame Street one day. And because at that time, any child under 16 years of age was not allowed to go on the Cape to watch a launch. So I called Sesame Street, and I told them, you know, this is really important for the young people in this country to see these things. They can't see them in person, so vicariously, we need to do something so that they can see a launch and see what it's all about. and you know, to motivate these kids in school. Well, to make a long story short, they said, you know, call back in a week, and I said, okay. So I called back in a week, and they said, yeah, we can gather the crew to come down, but we need something in return. I said, what's that? And they said, well, if you'll name your spacecraft Big Bird, then we'll come down and do the show. And I said, that was the end of the conversation. So then I picked up the phone and called Fred in Pittsburgh, where he was filming his show then. And on the very same phone call, I never even got off the phone with him, he put me on hold for a minute. He called Nova Crew up in Boston, and he scheduled a taping at the Cape 2 days before I went into quarantine for the flight. It was on Saturday, July 4th, I believe. And the Nova Crew came down, and Fred came down, and we had a nice conversation, and the result of that was that I went back to his show 7 or 8 times after that to kind of recap what we had done.
Why did he say yes?
Pardon?
Why did he say yes?
Well, you know, timing is everything. He was in the middle of a series of shows telling young people that, hey, dads leave the house from time to time. You know, dad goes down to the local grocery store, but he comes back. Dad goes to work, and he comes back that night. Dad goes on a trip, and after a couple of days, he comes back. Dad goes to the moon.
Yeah,
and after
sure,
a couple
dad
of weeks,
goes
he
to
comes
the moon.
Back, and everything is fine. So that was the message he was trying to give kids. Don't be concerned when your dad leaves, because he'll be coming back. And that just fit right into that little series that he was doing, and he was just so excited about doing it. I can't believe it.
Oh, but you write about this in the book, that mm-hmm. going to the moon is different than going to the grocery store. I mean, you had to think about the possibility, and you write about this, that perhaps you wouldn't come back, Al.
Oh, that's always in the back of your mind. But the project and the goal was so important that coming back was kind of secondary to getting to the moon and doing what we had to do. I think we all had the same kind of philosophy that, you know, if something should happen and we don't come back, you know, the one thing that's going to be everlasting after that is our names in history books. I think that we all had the same kind of thought process about all that, and that was that if something happens on the flight that becomes a disaster, the only thing I care about is that I was not the person that caused it. We wanted to make sure that we did our jobs the way they were, the way they should be done. And if you have a mechanical failure or something goes wrong that you can't control, that's the brakes. But you don't want to do it yourself.
Right. And what was the goal that was so important?
The goal is to land a crew on the moon and bring back evidence or information about the moon so that we get to know the moon much better. And by knowing the moon and how it formed and what it's all about, that gives us a kind of hindsight into how the Earth got formed. And we begin to build up a picture of how the solar system was formed. And that leads us to, I guess, events that create other solar systems and other planetary systems. So the better we know our own, the better we'll be able to figure out what's out there and possibly give us some direction on where to go.
Al Worden is our guest, and we have a number of people who would like to speak with you. Al, we will let them just stay on the phone for just a little while, and then they will be with you. Al Worden, Apollo 15 astronaut, and he has written about his journey to the moon and what happened when he got back to Earth, too, which is a story we have yet to hear. The book is Falling to Earth. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Oh, tomorrow during this time period, we're also going to have a wonderful time. John Katz is going to join us here in Milwaukee from Bedlam Farm. Many of you are very familiar with his books. He's an exquisite writer. not only does he write about the farm, Bedlam Farm, but all the wonderful animals he lives with. He's written 8 novels and 12 books of nonfiction, including Soul of a Dog, Izzy and Lenore, Dog Days, A Good Dog, The Dogs of Bedlam Farm. His latest book is Going Home, Finding Peace When Pets Die. The book before that talked about John and his dog's work with hospice. And he's an exquisite writer. So John is going to be with us in our studio, along with a dog. We don't know his or her name, from the Wisconsin Humane Society. So it's going to be a very special 10 o'clock show tomorrow. As it is today, how many people do you talk to who's gone to the moon? Actually, our guest this hour, Al Warden, is one of only 7 human beings to orbit the moon solo. And he writes about it in his book, Falling to Earth. We go to phone calls, starting with Chris in Wisconsin. Hi, Chris.
What was the shortest distance between any command module and any part of the lunar surface? And my second question is, were any of the Apollo astronauts not religious?
Well, that's a good question, too. Yeah.
Let me answer your first question first. We had a very unusual flight. Our landing site was out way beyond the knowledge we had of the gravitational forces of the moon. All the flights before ours went into an area that was plus or minus 10 degrees from the lunar equator because we knew what the gravitational constants were. You understand, of course, that the gravitational field around the moon is not constant. The large dark circles that we see on the face of the moon were caused by huge meteor impacts, and those meteors placed a great deal of mass under the surface on one side of the moon, which caused the moon to rotate and always face the Earth. So those large concentrations of mass perturbed the lunar gravitational field, and we weren't sure what they were going to do to us. Our landing site was 28 degrees north of the equator, and it was on the shore of Mare Imbrium, and there was a mountain range that Dave and Jim had to fly over to get there. Well, we went into an orbit the night before the landing that placed us something like 50,000 feet over the landing site. That's like 10 miles. And during the night, as we were sleeping, our orbit was changed by the gravitational forces of the moon. When we woke up the next morning, I looked out the window and I was really surprised because I felt like I was looking up at the top of that mountain. So I called Houston right away, and they said, "Gee, we're glad you called because you're getting a little close to the mountain." And so I said, "Well, how close are we?" And it was kind of now in hindsight, it's kind of funny, but the answer I got back was that, well, that mountain's 15,000 feet high. You are now at 31,000 feet that we have you tracking, plus or minus 9,000 feet. And I'm thinking, huh, that's what I need to get from an engineer, is a plus or minus number like that. That means they don't know what they're talking about. So if you do a little simple math, that put us at 22,000 feet, taking the worst case. And that mountain range was like 15,000 feet. So we went over it at about 7,000 feet. I'm probably pushing that a little bit. It was probably more like 10 or 12,000 feet, but we were awfully low at that point. And I don't think any of the other flights got that low to the moon. So we got pretty low in our orbit. And believe me, we saw some very, very small rocks with our naked eye because we were that close. As far as the religious thing is concerned, I think almost all the guys that flew were church-going people. They all had some religion in their background. Some focused on that more than others. We had 2 or 3 that became born-again Christians after their flight, and they give testimony around the world. Charlie Duke is a good example. Bill Pogue does.
Jim Irwin,
of course, on my flight was probably the most well-known of that group, and he founded a Christian fellowship organization called High Flight in Colorado Springs. It changed my view a little bit differently because although I've been an Episcopalian all my life, when I looked out at the universe out there, I realized that there was something a lot bigger than religion going for us. And that was whatever it is that formed the universe the way it is, was a lot bigger and a lot stronger and a lot more powerful and a lot more wise than anything that we ever take as religion. So it put me in a kind of a different frame of mind as far as religion is concerned.
Interesting answer. Anything else, Chris?
That almost, forgive me, but that almost sounds like you have reduced, you became less religious after the flight. Is that what you're saying?
No, I wouldn't say that. I just think that religion is a much, religion relates us to however the universe got in place. And I think I've taken a much broader view of religion than I had before. Probably just as intense as it ever was, but it's a slightly different perspective on it.
By the way, I watched your spacewalk on live television, and it was daytime here.
Yeah.
And the there was the marvelous mixture of pure darkness and bright light. And that was always very strange to see on television during the daytime, during your flight.
Well, you see, that's what happens when you get in space and you don't have an atmosphere to diffuse the light. We down here on Earth, even on the darkest night, there is light in the sky, and it's called dayglow. And it's light that gets refracted around the atmosphere. When you get out in space, you don't have that. So you're either in direct sunlight or in direct shadow. There's no in-between. So, yes, you get very, very distinct black and white when you're in space.
Thank you very much, Chris. From your vantage point, I would imagine in what you just said that you were struck by the vastness of space, the possibility we might, you have said, go somewhere else when this planet is no longer viable. Have you been following, and there's been lots and lots of years of scientific work on the question of what formed the universe. Do you follow all of that pretty avidly?
Well, I do on and off. It depends on what else I'm doing. The last couple of years I've been writing a book, so I've gotten away from it a little bit. But, yeah, I try and follow all of that, and I think that ideas are changing about how the universe gets formed. I'll just give you one example. Before our flight, the astronomers were beginning to talk about things called black holes. A black hole is an object that is so dense and so massive that nothing gets away from it, even light. So if you could take a picture of a portion of sky and there's a black hole in the middle of it, there's a dark hole in the middle of it, that might be a black hole, what we call a black hole. Well, we actually got an X-ray image in the constellation Cygnus with a black hole in the middle of it. So that kind of told the astronomers, yeah, there are such things as black holes. Now, black holes are probably the nucleus for a new galaxy. When they finally can't contain the mass anymore, they explode and they form a new galaxy. And in my opinion, I think the universe is self-sustaining that way because new galaxies are always formed and old ones die. So, yeah, I do follow that, and I think there is logic to the way the universe unfolds and is born. You know, galaxies are born and die. I don't think there's any big mystery. We just have never had the capability of looking out there far enough and tracking these things on universal time because, you know, in the universe we're talking billions of years, and here on Earth the lifetime is maybe 90 years or 80 years, something like that. So it's very difficult to think in terms of billions of years, but that seems to be the process that goes on.
Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. You folks have actually already covered what I was primarily going to ask about, which was the transformative nature of this experience. But first of all, I'd like to say to you, Mr. Warden, it is a genuine honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
We have become so blasé in this country in an odd sort of way about people who fly, astronauts going into space. And I think people here think that, oh, you know, you go to the space shuttle, on the space shuttle, and you go to the space station, and you're in space. But the reality is it's only you 24 members of the Apollo group that were really the only human beings that have been into deep space. And that's, I think that's a whole different category to me. And what I would like to ask
I agree with you, by the way. That's true.
And what I'd like to ask about is I heard an astronomer recently saying that he thought that an excellent place to park a telescope would be where you, one of the very few, have been to the dark side of the moon. And what I'd like to ask you is, how does that compare to where Hubble sits now, or the current telescopes, and what would be so advantageous about the dark side of the moon? I mean, I understand the lack of competing light sources and all that, but if you could just address that a little bit, and if you think that's, in fact, a good idea, too, as somebody who's actually seen that with your own eyes.
Mm. Isn't that amazing? We're talking to somebody who's seen that with his own eyes, Scott. I know. I do, too. Thank you for your call.
I have to say that putting a telescope on the backside of the moon, understanding that the moon rotates around the Earth once every 28 days, so you're in darkness for 14 days and in sunlight for 14 days. That 14 days of darkness would be an absolutely great spot to put a large telescope. The Hubble is wonderful. It's shown us things that we've never seen before, things that are just amazing out there in the universe, but it's only so big. If you could build a large telescope on the backside of the moon, you could probably multiply the power of the Hubble by 10 or 20 or 30 times, and then we'd be able to see much further out and begin to form, you know, more ideas about the universe out there. On the other hand, the Hubble has told us stuff that is just amazing, and it's in a good spot to do that. And it can look out at the universe all the time, not just 14 days out of every month. So it's a giant leap forward, and I think another giant leap forward would be if we put a telescope on the backside of the moon away from Earth, where we didn't have Earthshine to worry about. You see, when you're out there, Earthshine is almost as strong, almost as bright as sunlight, direct sunlight.
Really?
So you need to be away from Earthshine, and then every 14 days you'd get complete darkness when the sun sets, while the sun's on the other side of the moon, that you could do some wonderful astronomy work out there. Mm. And I think there's no question about it.
Thank you so much for your call, as always, Scott. Here's an email from Sue in Madison, who's delighted to talk to you and has always wondered about this. What causes the face in the moon? Is it, number one, reflection of different kinds of rocks? Number two, shadows from high mountains? Or number three, other ideas, which may be the correct answer?
Well, it's a combination of a lot of things. What we see as a face of the man in the moon is the result of meteor impacts some probably 3 billion years ago. And as I was saying before, it deposited a lot of mass just under the surface on one side of the moon, which made the moon rotate so that that face always looks at the Earth. Now, those big dark circles we see are meteor impact basins. What happened when these massive meteorites struck the moon, and they probably struck the Earth at the same time. But here on Earth, we have an environment, we have erosion, we have things that change, we have what we call tectonic plates that move around. On the moon, as small as it is, it didn't have any of that. So when these meteors struck, it was like dropping a pebble in a pond. You know, the first thing that happens is you get a little rebound feature where the pebble goes in. Then you get waves that propagate out from the center of impact. Those basins that we see, the circular basins, are the result of that. And what we're seeing is mountain ranges that describe the shoreline of those large basins are, in fact, the last wave that swept out from the center of impact. And then they froze in place. And the waves that were caught in between were subsequently covered with lava, so we don't see them. So what we see is a large circular basin, and you can imagine in the middle is where the meteor impacted, and the ring or the shoreline of those large basins is the last wave that froze in place. And even our landing site, the mountain that Dave and Jim had to fly over, was part of that last ring, and it was 15,000 feet high, and it was 250 miles from the center of impact. So you can imagine the enormous energy that was released when those meteors struck the moon. But those features are all the result of meteor impacts that we see from here. And, of course, the direction of the sun, the angle of the sun at the time, helps us see some of those things in the shadow patterns. And the color that we see, the darkness of the rings, or the darkness of the large circles, is more a matter of texture than it is of actual color. Because when you're up close and looking at them, there's not much difference in the color.
Hmm. Sally in Middleton, hi.
Hi. Thank you for this opportunity. You sound so certain, and I hope you are, to answer this question. I don't think it has an answer. I've always wondered, because things that we know on this Earth has a beginning and an end, whether it's solid or whether it's sickness or whatever it is, if it begins, it ends. Where does the universe end? Is there an ending?
That is the $64,000 question that a lot of astronomers are someday going to have to answer. I don't, in my own mind, I'll tell you what I think. I don't think there is any end. I don't think there's such a thing. I think it just goes on forever. We just can't see the rest of it. And we don't have powerful enough telescopes to see the rest of it. My own feeling is that the universe is endless, that there is no end to it, that there's no such thing as infinity or a beginning or ending of time. It's just there. How it got there beats me. I don't know, but it's there, and it's a lot bigger than we ever thought it was.
Thanks, Sally. Daniel in Rice Lake, hi.
Hello. Physiologically, what was the most exhilarating part of the flight, including adrenaline surges, and is weightlessness itself the ultimate thrill of space travel?
Well, I have to say probably launch was pretty cool. My heart rate at the time, my resting heart rate was around 55. We were in pretty good shape.
During
the launch, it went up to 70. So I got kind of excited during launch, but it wasn't a really big deal. We lifted off very slowly, and everything went according to plan, and so we were pretty comfortable with it. I would say the most anxious time in flight was just before we fired our engine to come back to Earth, because at that point we were down to one engine, and it had to work. And so the 10 minutes before that was probably the most anxious time on the flight. As far as the acceleration, exhilaration, I should say, being in space, it's just a lot of fun. You know, there's no such thing as zero gravity. We're always under the influence of a gravitational field. And it's like going over, let's say, it's like going over Niagara Falls in a barrel. You and the barrel are both falling at the same speed, but you, with respect to the barrel, are just floating around inside. That's what space is all about, and you kind of float around a spacecraft, but you're both going the same speed, the same time, the same direction. So it feels like what we call zero gravity. But I have to say there really isn't any such thing as zero gravity. And it's a lot of fun. In fact, we did a couple of experiments on flight. We took out the center couch one day, and we got Jim Irwin to roll up in a ball, and then Dave and I stood on either side of him. We started him spinning just to see what would happen. And as he was spinning, we'd say, okay, stick out an arm, and he'd stick out an arm, and his spin would slow right down. If you've ever watched skaters, when they do their spins, they put out their arms, and they slow down, they pull their arms in, and they go faster. Well, that's exactly what happens in space, too. There's nothing to restrain you. There's nothing that slows you down. In fact, we used to laugh and say, gosh, if we hadn't stopped Jim, he'd still be spinning. So that's kind of the pleasure of space.
Al Warden is our guest. He is talking about his experience, an extraordinary one, falling to Earth. He was an Apollo 15 astronaut, and with the Apollo 9 and 12 missions as well, and involved with the dangerous Apollo 13, which we know a whole lot about. We have yet to talk about Probably one of the more difficult times for him was after he returned to Earth. He had some interesting experiences and liked going through some of the communist countries who welcomed these astronauts, and we'll find out how he was welcomed back to Earth on various in various countries on Earth. And we'll take more phone calls. So if you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll welcome more phone calls in a moment. Let's talk about some of those celebrations when you came back to Earth. You write, Al, that you had more fun in the communist countries than you did anywhere else when you were overseas. Why?
Well, it's kind of interesting, Kathleen. One of the things that I found out on all those trips overseas was that people are people. It doesn't make any difference where you are or what kind of regime you're under. When you get somebody off to the side individually, we're all just the same kind of people. I found that when we went to Warsaw, as an example, the people were very warm and friendly. They loved to party. Same thing in Yugoslavia. They're a partying bunch of people. And they're just very easy to get along with, even though back in those days, there was a pretty rigid regime behind them. We had a host in Warsaw who was sort of the second man in their secret police. And we didn't know that at first, but we found out. And he was an international lawyer that lived in Warsaw. He controlled all of our appearances there. He didn't control us, but he controlled the people that we were going to talk to. And his control was pretty strong. But when we would get back to our quarters at night, why, he was a different person, and he'd have a couple of drinks, we'd sit and talk. And before we were finished in Warsaw, he came up to me one day, just the two of us off on the side, and wanted to know if I could find him a job in the United States. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting?
Yes.
that these people, even though they're under a communist regime, they're just people. I found the same thing true in Russia. We're very good friends with all the cosmonauts, and I've been there. And they're just... A pilot is a pilot. He could be a communist. He could be in a republic. He could be, you know, whatever. But a pilot is kind of a pilot. He wants to know about flying airplanes. He wants to know about going into space. And, of course, when you get into a communist country, they're all pretty good with their vodka. So they love to sit down and have a couple of vodkas and smoke a cigarette and talk about things.
Right.
And we talk about flying. We talk about we don't talk about politics. What I found is that people are people. Governments are the things that create problems.
Hmm. Let's go to Jerry in Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. What a fantastic show. Fantastic guest. I have a question, however. That is, what is his feelings about UFOs?
What's my feeling about UFOs? Well, I'll give you my stock answer. And that is, you bring me a piece of one that I can analyze and I find out that it's a material that's not here on Earth, then I'll say, okay, it had to come from somewhere else. I've never seen one. I hear all the stories just like everybody else, and everybody asks me about UFOs. My attitude is that I would believe it if I saw one. However, that doesn't really describe what I think about all that. What I believe is that there is intelligent life out there. And I'm very open-minded about that intelligent life visiting us, even though I've never seen one, and I don't know anybody who's actually seen one. But I do believe there's intelligent life out there, and probably if they're able to get here, they're a lot smarter than we are. So I do not deny the existence of intelligent life out in the universe somewhere. But I think when you bring it down to Earth and you start talking about unidentified flying objects, that's kind of a big muddy swamp to me. I've never seen one. I don't know any good evidence of it, but that does not say that it's not possible and that there are people that visit us.
Hmm. Well, I hope that intelligent life visits you on the golf course after we say goodbye.
Yeah, right.
That'd make your day.
You better visit my golf ball, not me.
Let's go next to you. Thanks, Jerry, for the call. Arnold, who's on the road to Milwaukee. Hi, Arnold.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had two questions for Al. And by the way, it's a total honor to be able to talk to somebody who flew all the way to the moon and back. It's pretty amazing. But anyway, my first question is, on your way back from the moon, you did the first deep space spacewalk, and I was wondering if you could kind of explain why that happened and what the purpose of that was. My sure. second question kind of comes from an experience of a kid watching Apollo 13, and there's that iconic scene where Tom Hanks has to fire the engine to get back into the right alignment to hit the Earth's atmosphere just right, and he's standing in the lunar module, and he just sort of like stands there and fires the engine, and he has to keep the Earth in the window so that he knows he's on course. And I was wondering, when you make that burn and you have to fire that engine, you have to hang on to something, right? Because otherwise the spacecraft is going to be going much faster than you are at that time. And if you could talk a little bit about that process.
Okay. Well, first, the extravehicular activity, the EVA spacewalk that I did on the way home, we carried two large cameras in an outside bay to photograph the surface of the moon. And as a matter of fact, I photographed with a mapping camera and with a high-resolution camera about 25% of the lunar surface. We had to recover that film because the only thing that survives the flight is what's inside the command module coming back through the atmosphere. Everything else burns up. So that film had to be recovered and placed in the command module so that we could get it back through the atmosphere. That was the purpose of the spacewalk. And that was the first time we'd carried those cameras on any of the Apollo flights. So it was a first-time effort. I practiced that so much that I could have done it in my sleep. As a matter of fact, it worked out so well that I didn't stay out there nearly as long as I wanted to, but I wanted to get the job done, and I did, and then I didn't have anything to do, so I had to get back inside and close the hatch and come back home. But that was the purpose of the spacewalk, was to recover that film that had been exposed during the lunar orbit part. As far as Apollo 13, you saw the movie with Tom Hanks at the controls of the lunar module. Understand that the lunar module, they stand up in the lunar module, and they flat like a helicopter. So when they do a maneuver like they did to come, you know, to change the trajectory to come back home, they're standing up, and they really have to hold on to something so that they don't, you know, crash into the back wall of the lunar module. When you're in the command module and you make the same maneuver, like when we made when we fired that engine to come back home, we had to accelerate about 3,000 miles an hour. We're sitting in couches where the thrust is through our chest, so we don't move. We're already back up onto a couch, so there's no danger of us going anywhere because that thrust of that engine kind of pushes us into the couch, and the thrust line is right through our chest. So that's fairly easy, and as a matter of fact, that was a fairly easy maneuver because that engine, I don't know, I guess we probably got maybe up to 1G of acceleration during that, and that was very easy. It's like Earth, like being here on Earth. So that wasn't very difficult. But the lunar module is a whole different thing.
Thanks so much for the call. Let's talk about and you spend a lot of the book talking about this, the error in ethical judgment that you say in retrospect seems laughingly trivial, which indeed it does, but it really was so destructive to your career for a while.
Well, I got to tell you, Kathleen, it was devastating at the time. I have to tell you, that a little of my background, I grew up on a farm here in Michigan, and I learned a lot from my grandfather who owned the farm. And I actually ran a farm, our own farm, from the time I was 12 until I went off to college. And that taught me a lot, a sense of responsibility, a sense of discipline. I went to West Point, and I learned how to follow. The motto at West Point, you have to learn how to follow before you can lead. We got on the flight, and Dave Scott, as our commander, had us agree to carrying some postal covers, commemorative postal covers on the flight. And, of course, Jim and I had never made a flight, so we didn't know, you know, we didn't really know what we were doing about any of that. So we kind of agreed to it with the understanding that all the other flights had done the same thing. Well, it turns out that some of those postal covers went to a German stamp dealer, and he sold them on the market. And a big investigation, and we were accused of breaking all kinds of rules and regulations and this and that and the other thing. And the upshot of the thing was that I got fired.
Mm.
And I went out to a research center in California, the Ames Research Center in San Francisco, to fill out my Air Force career. Turns out that that NASA actually violated laws that we didn't. The covers, the postal covers that we had in our possession, when this all came up, we turned in to NASA management while they were doing the investigation, with the understanding that we'd get them back when the investigation was over. Well, what happened is NASA decided that they would place them in the National Archives and we would never be able to get them. Hmm. Well, what that meant was they violated our constitutional right. They took our property without due process. They never went to a court. They never got a judge's approval. They never got a search warrant. We voluntarily turned these things in, and then they kept them. And you just can't do that. That's taking property without due process. And so that was the basis of a lawsuit that I filed back in 1983. And it didn't take long for them to realize that they had done us wrong, and we got them all back. So there were no rules that we violated. Maybe it was not a good thing to do, but you know, if you look on any auction house in the country that sells space memorabilia, you'll see postal covers from all the flights for sale.
Mm-hmm.
So they, in my opinion, they just decided to make an example of us.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody else had done the same thing.
Yeah. And do you feel that it really completely directed you in a different direction, that your career would have gone elsewhere if this had not come up?
Well, if it had not come up, I probably would have stayed in the program till I was too old to walk. I was very dedicated to the space program. I always held out the hope that I could make another flight, but once this came up, that was gone.
Right.
And I'm just thankful that I had been able to make one flight. I don't know that it changed direction. You see, the thing about a space flight is that it's a skill you learn. It's not really an intellectual thing. It's a skill. It's like driving a car. It's like flying an airplane. You learn how to do things in a certain way, and the only intellectual thing about it is if you have a problem, you got to figure out what it is. But basically, that's also a skill because you've trained for all those things. I think intellectual pursuits are much more important. Back in the 80s, it led me into running for the U.S. Congress, and I thought that was the most exciting thing I'd ever done.
Did you really?
I didn't win, but it was a great thing to do, and it was very intellectual. It took a lot of thought, and I talked to a lot of people, and developed lots and lots of ideas about things.
Mm.
I'm pretty conservative in nature. I wouldn't call myself a Republican by any means. But I'm really conservative in nature, and I think that I think there's a certain way that you do things, and that's what I got out of all that. That's my intellectual pursuit, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I beg to differ, because it seems to me as though you went through a great deal of intellectual rigor learning about the rocks on the moon and the geology. I mean, I consider you a geologist in addition to everything else, so...
Well, thank you. I guess that's probably true, although I don't quite see it that way.
Yeah. Let's go to Mark in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Mark.
Hello, and good morning.
Hi.
My question's kind of a hard one to phrase, but one of the reasons we put people into space is for the human experience of it. And my question is, as you're orbiting the Earth, I'm sure you're sensing or feeling like a life force or emotion or whatever, and I was just wondering how that was different while you were orbiting the moon. Did it feel dead, or did it feel alive, or, you know, what were your feelings?
That's a good question. The Earth has a very dynamic surface. It's covered with an atmosphere, and when you get into space, you can look back at Earth, and you can see where the cloud patterns are, and you can see the... One of the things that really amazed me on the flight was that I thought,
hey, you know those guys who drafted and drew those geography pictures that we studied when I was a kid? By golly, they must have been out in space, because it sure looked the same to me when I got out there as those old geography books. So I, you know, that was kind of interesting. When you get to the moon, it's a pretty dead object out there. There's nothing going on. It has no atmosphere. What's there today was there a billion years ago, pretty much the same way it is today. So, yeah, it's a whole different thing, but it's absolutely spectacular because there's nothing to moderate, if you will, the topography of the moon. There's no erosion. There's no wind. There's no water there. So the moon is the same as it was a billion years ago, and the Earth is totally different because of all of the dynamic processes that we see here on Earth. So, yeah, they're totally different things.
Hmm. Your description, I like these words that you used in the book about the moon. It looked ancient, battered, pockmarked, and dead.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, Al, it has been such a pleasure. I'm so glad we found you. It was just a lovely hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's my pleasure, and you might tell your listeners that if they want to find out more about me and about the book, go to my website, alwooden.com.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, very shortly there will be some videos of my days with Fred Rogers and the questions that he asked. So it's kind of interesting.
Oh, Al, yeah. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
I think you'd enjoy that. There are four little clips of Fred and I talking on my website. And I think that would be interesting to people. Also,
yes, it would.
It will give lots of information about the book and where to get it and all that kind of stuff.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you so much. Fred Rogers was a saint, if you ask me. Al Worden, and it's Al Worden, WORDEN.com. It'd be fun to see those clips with Fred Rogers. His book is Falling to Earth, published by Smithsonian Books. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for putting this show together.